listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Since President Obama announced the launch of the Federal Brain Initiative in April 2013, research efforts have been underway to revolutionize our understanding of that important organ. In early October, the NIH handed out the initial $46 million in research grants to support the goals of the Brain Initiative. Stanford received some awards from those funds. And here at Stanford, Bill Newsom is challenging faculty to think broadly about the intersections of neuroscience with society, engineering, medicine, and other fields through the Stanford Neuroscience Institute's Big Ideas Initiative. What would they hope to achieve if money and time were no object? Newsom, who's been working in the field for nearly three decades, is vice chair of the Federal Brain Initiative and director of the Stanford Neuroscience Institute. In this podcast, he delves into the state of neuroscience, where the field is headed, and the challenges scientists face in trying to better understand the brain and develop new therapies for brain disorders. Bill Newsom, thank you for joining me in One-to-One.
My pleasure.
You were the co-leader, I just discovered. The group is dispensed. You were the co-leader of the working group that made recommendations to guide the National Brain Initiative. And I wondered if you could give us some history about why at this particular moment in neuroscience, neurology, was this initiative important?
Sure. It's extremely important because people realize and understand that neuroscience is undergoing a revolution at this point in time. We have made slow and steady and really good progress over the last few decades. But the tools that we've had to make measurements from the brain and understand the meaning of brain activity have been very limited. And in any area of science, the progress that you can make is limited by the tools you have at your disposal. And what's happened in the last 5 to 10 years is invention of revolutionary new tools that are allowing us to map the brain's connections in fundamentally new and different ways, that are allowing us to measure the electrical and chemical activity of systems and circuits of cells in the brain in fundamentally new ways, and that are allowing us to conceive of the meaning of these signals, build models, and deal with large data sets in fundamentally new ways. And those of us who've been in this business for, 35 years, the way I have now, are really having to say, whoa, and we have to take a step back and rethink what does it mean to be an experimental neuroscientist in the future with all of these powerful new tools at our disposal? What are the best experiments to do? And how do we train students to be productive neuroscientists in this future that we're coming into? So I think the White House, in starting the National Brain Project, really got this right. We are all accustomed to some things coming out of Washington, and we say, what in the world are those people smoking back there, right? Mm-hmm. But I think they really got this one right. They really put their finger on something that here's a field that matters so much for our understanding of who we are as human beings, for being able to treat devastating neurological and psychiatric disease, and for being able to create a future where brains and machines interface more and more productively and creatively. And that is going to be a revolution, a scientific revolution, I think, in the 21st century.
Hey, what was the work of the working group? What did you actually do? What did you propose?
When this Brain Initiative was first announced by the White House, it actually caused a lot of consternation within the neuroscience community worldwide. Our national economy is under stress right now. Funding levels for biomedical research have dropped by 20% in real purchasing dollars over the last 10 years, which is a tragedy, by the way. And many neuroscientists were wondering, where did this come from? Who vetted it? What is this idea? Is this actually going to be a good use of money, or is it going to be a poor use of money? And there was a lot of alarm. And NIH, the National Institutes of Health, to their credit, the NIH director decided to get out in front and own this and assemble a sort of a blue ribbon committee of neuroscientists to take a look at the field, just step out of our laboratories. I was the co-chair of the committee. And we were asked to step out of our laboratories and really take a long view of the field, where we've been, where we can go in the future, how we could spend some hard-earned, but not a great deal of taxpayer money, but how could we spend it and target it to make the biggest change in the field of neuroscience and really propel a leap forward in the science? So we took a year to do that, basically. We held workshops. We had lots and lots of experts in different aspects of the field in to talk with us and argue with us. And, you know, there were no fist fights, but it was quite animated at certain points. We consulted with leaders of the clinical professional societies, like the neurosurgeons and the neurologists and the neuroradiologists, the psychiatrists. We consulted with the Society for Neuroscience Leadership, the largest professional society of neuroscientists in the world. And we argued among ourselves and went back and forth and really tried to pinpoint where we thought the best opportunities were.
You've talked about collaborations important at the national level. And at the local level here at Stanford, at the brain, at the Stanford Neuroscience Institute, you've made a point of really including a broad range of fields, collaboration, policy, law, education. Why is this collaboration particularly important now?
I think it's important now because neuroscience is going to interact with every other area of the university and ultimately almost every area of society. Already, the legal system is being challenged by the introduction of brain scanning data into the courts as evidence. And the federal judges and state judges don't know what to do with this evidence and have actually sent out pleas to neuroscientists to help teach them what this means and what use it is in the courtroom. My colleague Hank Greeley in the law school here at Stanford says that a very large percentage of all civil litigation in the United States is due to pain and suffering that extends long after some actual injury. And right now, the only way people have to judge pain and suffering is the subjective testimony
anecdotal.
Of the person, anecdotal, and expert testimony. And Hank says, he looks at me and he points his finger at me and he says, if you guys could come up with some way to objectively assess the state of central pain circuits in the brain, you would make a huge impact on civil litigation in this country. So similar stories can be told about education. You know, we would really like a predictive kind of neuroscience. So we can scan the brain of a seven-year-old, simple half-hour brain scan, and we can say to a parent, maybe your child is a little slow in reading now, but all systems look go, and you shouldn't worry about this. Or we can say to another parent, your child's brain shows a pattern that we can predict is going to have trouble in traditional styles of learning. And here's another alternative you ought to be considering and actually be able to predict those kinds of things. Or do similar things in decision-making and economics and why do people make the decisions they make, investment decisions, retirement decisions. Why do they so often make faulty decisions, right? And how do collectives of people make decisions that no individual person would make? So neuroscience, I think, is going to inform deeply these areas of dialogue. But a thing that's not often realized is that neuroscience is going to be informed by these people. Educators in the classroom take the behavior of their pupils very seriously, and they recognize patterns, and they know that one kid is different from another kid. And they can come to the neuroscientist and say, I've got this evidence right in front of my face. I have a hunch there's something very different about these kids' brains, and why don't you study that? Or economists can bring to us observations they make about decision-making processes that are clearly faulty, but so many people make them, and ask neuroscientists, here's a phenomena that is in need of explanation. So I think any area that takes human behavior and the study of human behavior seriously has a lot to teach neuroscience. And that kind of dialogue is exactly what we want to create here.
Are there any specific challenges in neuroscience that are uniquely well-suited to solve here at Stanford?
Oh, yes. I mean, Stanford is, above all, the place where this kind of broadly integrated neuroscience ought to take place. And that's because we have world-class base of neuroscientists, both in clinical departments, you know, doctors who actually treat patients, and in basic science department, basic neurosciences and basic cellular and molecular physiology. We have huge strength there, but we have a world-class School of Engineering right across the street. We have world-class humanities and sciences with world-class physics and psychology and chemistry right across the street. We have world-class business school and school of law and education only slightly farther afield. And the cool thing about Stanford is that you can literally walk from one office to the other. And our students don't really recognize traditional departmental and geographical boundaries.
Right.
And Stanford has this unique advantage of being in Silicon Valley, where the pathway to taking ideas and discoveries out of academia and translating them into real practical instruments and tools and products is a well-worn pathway. So I think Stanford, I can't think of any place in the world that meets all of those criteria, where, that has more promise for spearheading, being the sharp point of the spear in this new neuroscience that's coming in the next century. I mean, Stanford is the place that ought to be right at the sharp tip of the spear.
You've had your own sort of brain initiative of allocation of dollars here recently, and you had an unusual funding competition, which you call Big Ideas. What was funded, and what specifically were you looking? Did you have targets specifically that you wanted to go at?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. And the answer is no, I did not have specific targets that I wanted to go after. I agree. John Hennessy asked me to be director of the Neurosciences Institute here at Stanford about 3 weeks before Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, called me and asked me to be chair of the planning committee, co-chair of the planning committee for the National Brain Initiative. And I didn't feel like I could say no to either one of those because they both seemed really important, and I was at a point in my life where I could, you know, tackle these issues. So so I went into the Stanford initiative with a very open mind. And the one thing that I had a deep conviction about is that the best ideas for how to do this were going to bubble up from Stanford students and faculty. They were not going to be imposed from the top down by me. I know faculty and students well enough to know that's not going to work. What you have to do is create an environment where groups of faculty from disparate disciplines will talk with each other. And if they just start talking with each other and exchanging ideas, then new research proposals are going to come. They're going to bubble up, and they're going to be creative, and they're going to be good. So I was dedicated to that proposition, that my job was to give the faculty a arena where they could talk with each other and allow their natural passion and their natural creativity to take over. And we would build this institute from the bottom up in that sense. So we started out last year actually with a series of small faculty dinner discussions through the fall. We had about 8 to 10 faculty at each dinner discussion. We reserved 8 dates, figuring we could probably fill up 6 of them, and we'd cancel the 2 that were, you know, the least subscribed. But what happened is that we filled up all 8, and we had to schedule 3 more in January to accommodate all of the interest, which was incredibly rewarding. And people really enjoyed those intimate kinds of meetings where we had a meal together and drank a little wine together. And basically we said, okay, what could we do at Stanford that would really change the face of neuroscience and really make things different in this field? You know, and engineers who were curious came and said, well, here's what I'm working on. Here are my devices. Here are my approaches. Is that any use to you guys, you neuroscience? And neuroscientists would be there, well, here's the real bottlenecks I face in my lab. And if only I had X, we could get past this bottleneck. And soon the creative juices were flowing, and we felt like we had to find some way to harness that energy. We knew we had a good thing going from these conversations, and that's where the Big Ideas in Neuroscience competition came from. We asked groups of faculty to send us 2-page letters of intent, and, you know, not a lot of effort, just give us 2 pages and show us your interdisciplinary team. You know, what's your plan? What's the big idea that you want to tackle? What's your team, your interdisciplinary team, and at a general level, what's your plan for tackling that big idea, and how will the world be different as a result if you succeed? And we got 22 of these LOIs involving about 300 faculty from, you know, somewhere between 60 and 70 departments. I can't remember the exact number, and across a broad range of schools. And it was remarkable, the creativity. We then selected 10 of those 22 to give us full proposals, full 10-page proposals. We said, all right, take this and run with it and give us now a more in-depth plan of what you actually propose to do. And it was a little weird because, you know, the hope was to raise philanthropic money to fund these early seed level pilot kinds of ideas. You know, we were asking people to be a little outrageous and propose things that would never be funded.
Outrageous, how so? Risk taking?
Risk taking, exactly. We asked people to take risks and to think big. And in the current economic climate, those kinds of projects are not easy to get funded. When biomedical research money gets tight, as it is now, funding agencies tend to get conservative. Mm-hmm. And they want to know, if I lay out X dollars, I'm going to get Y product in return. And that is not a recipe for risk-taking, for really propelling a field forward. That's a recipe for slow, incremental change. And right now, we have these talented faculty at Stanford, many of them young faculty. They're at the most creative parts of their career. They're at a place where they're thinking big and dreaming big, and we wanted to create this kind of mechanism to allow them to do that. So, which means that, you know, we really have to raise philanthropic money to get these things started. Now, we're not going to put them on some kind of, you know, long-term life support. If the ideas take off and they work well, they're going to attract outside funding and they're going to inspire other people to get on these sorts of new ways of thinking about problems in neuroscience as well.
Several of these collaborations are with engineering. What are the specific challenges that need to be solved in neuroscience with engineering? What are the specific engineering challenges that need to be solved?
Good question. And I've spoken before about, you know, these technical revolutions that are happening in neuroscience that make this such a propitious moment for this kind of effort at both the national level and at the Stanford level. So one of the revolutions is being driven by, well, a couple of them actually, are being driven by advances in optics. And these are people in applied physics and engineering that are driving this stuff. So in the past, our only way to record electrical activity out of the brain was through electrodes, actual little tiny wires that you would snug up to the brain or actually sometimes insert into the brain and measure electrical signals, one wire, five wires, or maybe, you know, at the outside, 50 or 60 wires at a time. But now, new chemical engineering techniques allow you to put novel genes into cells that fluoresce. They emit fluorescent light whenever they're electrically active. And then by lowering a microscope and imaging the surface of the brain, the cortex with a microscope, you can actually record from thousands or more recently 10,000 of these neurons simultaneously and measure their electrical activity, not with any electrodes, but just with optics. So there's a revolution in optics as applied to the brain that is enabling data sets of a power and scope that we have never imagined before in the history of neuroscience. Another example is the invention of optogenetics here at Stanford, which you and I have talked about before in a previous podcast. And this is genetic engineering, and it's the ability to actually insert genes and sets of genes into cells that allow you not just to read out the signals and see them glow when they're electrically active, but allow you by shining light on the cells to actually change the signals in a neural circuit. And you can do this in awake animals who are trained on some maze running task, and you can actually turn circuits on and off and see which circuits are the actual critical ones for spatial memory and for navigation. And it's just a remarkable change that's come from that technology and that sort of genetic and bioengineering that was invented in the Department of Bioengineering here at Stanford.
By Carl Dieseroff.
Exactly. You know, another cool example, Paul, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry was just given to a group, including C.W. Mourner, chair of the chemistry department here at Stanford. It was given about 3-4 weeks ago for the invention of a technique called super-resolution microscopy. You know, our ability to look with microscopes at finer and finer detail insides of cells has been limited by fundamental physics, the diffraction limit of light. But the three people who won that Nobel Prize were involved in inventing ways called super-resolution microscopy to exceed the diffraction limits of light, to actually do a workaround and see unprecedented detail inside of cells And so one of our big ideas that comes from two more Nobel Prize winners, Tom Sudhoff and Steve Chu here at Stanford, wants to apply that kind of super-resolution microscopy to looking at the structure of synapses and do it in time and watch synapses change as learning takes place and watch which molecules actually get trafficked in what subcellular compartments and bring that world of the synapse, which is where all learning and memory takes place, and bring that world alive into empirical science. So these are just examples of some technologies, and there are more. Brain-machine interfaces, I could talk about that. The contributions from engineering and applied physics here have been huge in this past decade of radical change in neuroscience, but they're going to be even greater in the future. I think we've only begun to scratch the surface.
Where do you hope that we go in solving the puzzle, the riddle of mental illness? Tom Insull, the director of the National Institutes of Mental Health, said that we don't know enough about the brain to treat mental health issues. Where would you say we are as far as understanding the mechanics, the mechanisms, the structure of mental illness? And are there some basic things about the brain that we need to know that we don't know right now in addressing the most debilitating issues that confront a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Insull is a really thoughtful guy, and it's great to have someone like him as head of the National Institute of Mental Health, because he has been in the trenches. He is both a scientist and a psychiatrist, and deeply thoughtful about how the science and the psychiatry and the needs of families coping with mental health issues and what those needs are and how those three things interact. And Tom himself was here to speak at the opening symposium of the Neurosciences Institute at Stanford. And Tom really emphasized the importance of this circuit level, this sort of black box level between the single cells and between the large scale patterns of activity that we can record with imaging. And the need to, he emphasized our need to understand those circuits, to understand how they were, activity in those circuits were actually related to all aspects of mental and cognitive processing, from seeing to learning to remembering to emotion to decision making. You know, so much psychiatric illness is due to disorders of emotional regulation, but others are due to disorders of decision making. I mean, schizophrenia being a classic case of that, and others due to disorders of perception and belief. You know, the most effective talk therapy right now that we have is cognitive behavioral therapy. And the man who invented that, Dr. Aaron Beck of the University of Pennsylvania, said, you know, what we're really about here is changing people's belief structures. And changing those belief structures changes the brain. Well, what parts of the brain does it change? We don't know that yet. But we are involved in trying to discover that. And I think ultimately, good treatments for mental diseases are going to come from a combination of this sort of top-down approach and a bottom-up approach. So the classic bottom-up is you write a prescription and you give a drug and you set it loose in the nervous system, and that drug goes everywhere in the nervous system and it binds with its receptors wherever they may be. That's a bottom-up intervention. The top-down intervention is the cognitive behavioral therapy, a talk therapy. And recent studies have shown that those two approaches are more effective together than either of them is in isolation. And so we have to take seriously the whole person and their beliefs about the world, but we also have to take seriously these neural mechanisms. And we can get these bottom-up neural mechanisms much better than they are now. I mean, one of our big ideas programs that we're sponsoring concerns ways to actually target and fine-tune circuit activity inside the human brain non-invasively, without having to cut a hole in the head, without having to put an electrode in. Although we do those things, and we treat neurological conditions and increasingly psychiatric conditions right now with stimulating electrodes. But the ideal would be to accomplish those circuit tuning procedures without having to do anything invasively inside the head. And one of our big ideas is exactly about that kind of non-invasive, getting better non-invasive tools for tuning brain circuit activity. And that would be much, much better than sort of shotgun approaches that we have with drugs if we can do it non-invasively.
Where do you see the biggest challenges in the next 3-5 years in neuroscience?
The biggest challenges are continuing to improve the technology. The technological revolutions that we have going on right now are mostly applicable at the current moment to research in experimental systems, different kinds of animal model systems. In order to get optical imaging out of the human head, in order to do optical or genetic manipulations in humans requires risks and steps that we're not ready as a society or technically ready to make yet. And improving these technologies so that they can be done, these kinds of measurements and circuit tuning procedures can be done non-invasively, I think that's the single biggest challenge. If we could read out signals from the human brain and read in signals, actually do the circuit tuning in the human brain non-invasively at a spatial scale on the order of a millimeter or less and with fairly rapid time, it would revolutionize neuroscience and it would revolutionize the treatment of neurologic and psychiatric disease. There's no question in my mind about that. So I think improving those technologies is still a big, big challenge. But even once you have the technologies, there's intricate, meticulous scientific detective work that has to be done. You know, I once saw a sort of bumper sticker that somebody had pasted on a rack of instrumentation in their lab, and it said, "High-tech circuitry is no substitute for guts." And there's a lot of truth to that. High-tech tools by themselves do not solve scientific problems. The sort of nose to the grindstone scientific detective work,
just day in and day out.
The day in, day out, and the passion to get it right and to really know and to really understand how some circuit is working and how that's related to some measurable behavior. That is, continues to be a huge challenge. And then, you know, the other challenge, quite frankly, Paul, is funding. I mean, when we're in an environment where the real purchasing budget of the National Institutes of Health has dropped by 20% in 10 years, how do you keep convincing talented young people to come into that field? If our nation is sending a message that we're deprioritizing science and we're prioritizing whatever else, how do we convince our brightest, our best and our brightest to that this is a field with a really, really bright future?
So how do you?
It's not easy, Paul. I mean, it is a fact that more students who graduate with PhDs go into fields outside of science than used to be the case. We've documented this. We follow our graduates. We have to do this for NIH training grant purposes. Now, some of that's good. You know, this is talked about sometimes in years past as alternative careers. And I don't even like the phrase alternative careers. I just like different potential careers. But we need PhD-level trained scientists in journalism. We need them in communications, like you do so effectively. We need them in government. We need them in regulatory agencies. We need that kind of level of expertise desperately in our country. We need it increasingly in the legal profession, and increasingly we need scientific expertise in business professions as companies try to learn what's the real deal with climate change and what does it mean for our business model going forward and how do we cope with this stuff. It's important for governments. I mean, you know, my wife is a scientist who did 5 years in consulting, and she did a major project for the government of Morocco on the future of water supplies, and they have to decide whether to invest in desalination plants or not and what climate change holds for their country. I mean, this is science that really matters in the real world. So I think that it's great that a lot of PhD students are going to careers outside of academic, laboratory-oriented science. But in order for the science to thrive and the academic science to thrive and the new discoveries to get made, we've got to keep some of that talent base in the field. And some private foundations and philanthropic partners are helping with that. There are foundations that are giving out grants to get young faculty started on independent careers and setting up their laboratories. Increasingly, universities like Stanford and the major research universities are giving larger and larger sort of what we call startup packages to faculty, young faculty at the time that they're hired. But still, the bread and butter driver that everyone has to come up against and deal with at some point is, can you get your research funded by federal agencies? Because the federal government is still where the biggest dollars come from and where the biggest source of support is. And there is no substitute for that, no substitute in sight. You know, you sometimes hear people say, well, the private sector, you know, can do this more efficiently than the government. And I simply don't think that's true. The private sector is constrained by their obligations to shareholders. And shareholders notoriously look at the results of the next quarter and the next 6 months and the next year, and they cannot afford to look 10 years down the road and 15 years down the road and 20 years down the road. And in academic science right now, in this National Brain Initiative and in our brain initiative, our neuroscience initiative here at Stanford, we are doing exactly that. We're trying to look 10 years down the road and say, you know, what can the investments we make now yield in 10 years or yield in 20 years? And we're trying to take that long point of view.
At the end of 10 years, if you look at specific achievements, what will you be most excited, most proud of, most, what will really, you'll say, boy, we really did achieve something?
So that's a great question, and it's one that I spend a lot of time thinking about, and the Neurosciences Institute Executive Committee spends a lot of time thinking about. And I can name several for you. I mean, one thing that I would really like to see, I would like to see fundamental substantive change on at least one devastating neurological or psychiatric disease. And I don't really care which one. Give me Alzheimer's, give me autism, give me depression, give me Parkinson's disease. But at the end of 10 years, if we can really have a breakthrough in understanding of what causes one of those diseases mechanistically and have a therapy that dramatically improves people's lives, that's something I would say it's worth it. We've done our job. Another one is, you know, what we talked about a few minutes ago about predictive knowledge about educating children. If neuroscience could actually make a positive change for the better in how we educate kids, if we could actually look at brains and counsel families wisely about models of education, given that individual child's brain circuitry and makeup, if we had that kind of knowledge and could make that level of difference, I would feel really proud of that. If we could get brain-machine interfaces to the point where they really can create useful vision for blind people, and not just crude, blurry vision, but something that actually approximates useful walking around vision. If we could have visual prosthetics that restore functional sight to the blind, that would be a huge step forward. And I think this is not fantasy. It's not daydreaming. I mean, we're taking the first steps in effective motor prosthetics right now. Right here at Stanford, some of this research is going on where you put an array of electrodes into a person's. Now, this was all vetted in animal research ahead of time. But right now, the first patient to be done at Stanford, the first human patient has been done that has an array of electrodes in the motor cortex. And this is a person who has ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and is gradually losing motor neuron function. But simply by thinking about the movements that she would like to make, she can control a cursor on a computer screen and type out email messages. And the scientists are actually reading these electrical signals out in real time and interpreting, okay, she wants to move the cursor up and to the right, or she wants to move it to the left, or she wants to stop it now. And she can go out and click a keyboard and type out email messages at about 8 to 10 words per minute. You know, which is, it's not blinding speed, but it's about as well as I hunt and peck with two fingers. So if we could make those things real, that allows an amputee to actually guide a prosthetic arm just by thinking about where they want to move it, that would be huge. And then I think that another thing that's going to be really rewarding that we've got to come to grips with is something you and I mentioned a little earlier, is about how do we train the neuroscientists of the future in this rapidly changing the world. We've got to somehow take students who care about neuroscience and have a foot in the classical neurosciences and another foot in a related discipline that interacts with neuroscience, whether that be engineering, whether it be education, whether it be chemical biology, whether it be molecular biology, whether it be statistics, but somehow make it possible for students to acquire training in both areas. Those are the students who are going to make the biggest impact on development of neuroscience in the future. So give me two or three of those, and I'll be a happy camper 10 years from now.
Bill Newsom, thank you for joining me in 1 to 1.
My pleasure.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.